From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a look inside a walled-off and heavily patrolled section of Baghdad that's a little bit of America, complete with bacon cheeseburgers and speed limit signs. We'll talk about the American occupation of Iraq with Rajiv Chandrasekharan. He was the Washington Post's Baghdad bureau chief in 2003 and 4. His new book is called Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. Also, actor Ed Harris tells us about his new film Copying Beethoven. He plays the classical composer in the waning years of his career when he was struggling to complete his Ninth Symphony. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. In the Green Zone, the secure area for coalition forces and American diplomats in Iraq, there's a dry cleaner with a sign on the wall which reads, "Remove ammunition from pockets." That's just one of the revealing details in a new book about the Green Zone by my guest, Washington Post Assistant Managing Editor Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He was the newspaper's Baghdad bureau chief for the first 19 months of the occupation in Iraq. His book is called Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. He describes a world specially created to make Americans comfortable in a war-torn land, and he details what he considers the sometimes misguided efforts of American administrators to quickly transform Iraq's economy and political culture. Before heading the Post's Baghdad bureau, Rajiv Chandrasekaran reported from Indonesia, Egypt, and the post-9/11 war in Afghanistan. Well, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, welcome to Fresh Air. You called your book Imperial Life in the Emerald City. Remind us what exactly the Green Zone in Baghdad is, who lived there, what it looked like.
Well, the Green Zone is a 7-square-mile enclave, the center of Baghdad. Before the U.S.-led war to topple Saddam Hussein, it was the site of Saddam's Republican Palace and many other associated government buildings for his bodyguards, for his ministers. It was a walled-off enclave that ordinary Iraqis could never enter. They just simply drove very quickly by the walls on the outside, lest they be accused of gawking and picked up by the secret police. After the Americans arrived in Baghdad, it was the ideal place for them to set up shop. And it quickly became a place where soldiers congregated. And then a few weeks into the U.S. presence in Iraq, it was determined that this would be the ideal place to seat the occupation government. And they took over Saddam's Republican Palace, and it became the headquarters of the Coalition Provisional Authority. But the Green Zone is more than just the marble-walled palace. It's the whole area around it. And it became a little America. It became a land of swimming pools, of bars. There were at least 7 bars and discos in the Green Zone. It became an enclave that was taken over in some parts by the large defense contractor Halliburton. It became this sort of otherworldly place that was so divorced from the reality of post-war Baghdad. As soon as you crossed over those walls, you could really see this chaotic, dysfunctional country that was still sort of smoldering from the ruins of the looting. But when you went inside the Green Zone, it was this sort of sterile, almost Disneyland-like environment where, as I say in my book, you know, sort of the calm sterility of an American subdivision prevailed.
You made a number of interesting observations about food in the Green Zone. What was served?
Well, it was American fare. You could live for 6 months in the Green Zone and never eat an Iraqi meal, never eat kebab, hummus, flatbread. It was almost always sort of down-home cooking with a southern flair, a lot of grits, a lot of bacon, a lot of sausage, burgers. And what's interesting here is the bacon was pork bacon. You know, we're in the middle of a Muslim country. Pork is a food that's offensive to Muslims, yet Halliburton persisted in serving it in the dining hall in the Green Zone. And almost for every meal, you'd go there for breakfast, and there was pork bacon in the buffet for breakfast. Lunchtime, you had pork hot dogs, and dinner, you could find bacon cheeseburgers or pork loin. It was amazing to me the cultural insensitivity that was displayed, because inside that dining hall, it wasn't just Americans and Brits eating, but there were a number of Iraqis who had been brought into the palace, carefully vetted, mind you, but brought into the palace to work as translators, to work as janitors, to work as other sort of support personnel. And they were forced to eat at that palace, and they were forced to get food from the very same buffet that was piled high with pork.
Now, you talk about a guy who was Halliburton's customer service liaison for the dining services, a fellow named Michael Cole. Was he aware of this issue of porks, of Muslims being surrounded by all this pork?
He certainly was. He was a young kid, but he had a good heart, and he certainly knew that this was offensive to the Muslims who ate at the dining hall, and in fact, offensive to the Muslims who were serving the food. No Iraqis were actually allowed to serve the food. They were worried that they might actually poison the food. So Halliburton brought in a bunch of Pakistani and Indian laborers to come in and do all of that work. This young guy, Mr. Cole, was at least attuned enough to that that he claims never ordered pork in the dining hall. But when this was brought to his attention, and he took it up the chain of command, what he was told was that the morale of the Americans was more important, that it was more important to give people good down-home cooking so they wouldn't get homesick. And if it meant that some Iraqis were offended, well, so be it.
Now, you mentioned that I guess Saddam's palace was one place where some activities occurred, but that there was such a need for housing that a lot of the green zone was, in effect, trailer parks, right? What kinds of accommodations did people have to live in?
Well, initially, what had happened was a lot of the American personnel bunked right in the palace because there are about 256 rooms in that place. There was ample space for the first wave of Americans to come in and find accommodation. But then as the CPA grew and grew, they ran out of space in this vast palace. So then they moved into the Al Rashid Hotel. And the Al Rashid then served as the principal dormitory for the occupation authority. And it did so until the fall of 2003, when insurgents hit the hotel with a barrage of rockets, killing one CPA staffer and wounding a few others. And at that point, they all sort of moved back closer to the palace, and they moved into a whole set of trailers. And this massive trailer park grew, and they were sort of subdivided into little mini trailer parks, and they took on names like Poolside Estates and Ocean Cliffs. And these weren't really great trailers. There were pretty dilapidated things that were brought in again by Halliburton, who I'm sure charged the government a pretty penny for them. It was by no means grand housing, and they were particularly vulnerable to mortars because, you know, the trailers have only very thin corrugated metal atop of it. So they eventually started to pile the sandbags along the sides of them. It took on a very sort of otherworldly scene as you'd walk through these trailer parks and kind of snake your way through these sandbagged encampments to get into people's little hovels that had a little single bed in it and some plastic chairs. And this was the new American housing.
And it was interesting that there was a difference between the trailers the British had and the ones the Americans had.
Yeah, well, the British, who have a longer history of occupation than Americans do, I think figured it out a little quicker, some of the things they needed to do. So instead of going to Halliburton and getting some second-rate trailers, they had theirs outfitted with furniture from the Swedish company IKEA. And they, I think, anticipated the potential for mortar attacks on the green zone. So they set up many of their trailers in a parking garage in the green zone. So there was a cement covering on it, which gave them an added layer of protection. It was a degree of foresight that some of the American planners did not have.
What about people who dated? I mean, were there places for intimacy in the green zone?
Not that many. So it forced people to get creative. You know, initially, the ratio of men to women was something like 10 to 1. So men, as they started to woo women, began to refer to themselves as operationally single. And women in the green zone began to receive attention that sort of verged on harassment. You know, one woman recounts going into a meeting and introducing herself to a man, and the man says to her, "Oh, I know who you are. We know who all the pretty girls are." But those who did sort of want to hook up, they'd have to do it sort of surreptitiously. They'd have to walk to some quiet corner of the green zone or find an abandoned office in the palace. One place that people were known to sort of hook up, they thought was actually quite private, was in the porta potties in the back of the palace.
The porta potties.
Hardly romantic. It's a disgusting thought, but there was a belief, particularly among military personnel out there, that it was perhaps the safest place because you could lock the door and be assured that nobody was going to come in.
Rajiv Chandrasekharan was the Washington Post's Baghdad bureau chief after the American-led invasion of Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. His book, based on his coverage of the occupation in Iraq, is called Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. Give us a sense of who some of the civilians, what kind of civilians inhabited the Green Zone, their ages, backgrounds?
It was a motley assortment of people, everywhere from young, jobless college graduates to war zone adventurers, to people who had had a little experience overseas, to a lot of people who had never left America. One of my most telling statistics that I write about in the book about the Green Zone is that more than 50% of the people who came out to work for the occupation authority applied for their first passport to come out and work there. So a lot of people who had never ventured beyond the shores of the United States. And a lot of them were really young. You had a lot of people in their 20s who were looking for a little adventure. Many of them very loyal Republicans. That was a key criteria to be chosen to come out there. But it was a whole assortment of people. In fact, it's been described by others, and I share this view, that walking through the Green Zone, it was sort of like going to the bar in Star Wars, that whole, you know, motley assortment of people.
Were there Democrats in the Green Zone, I mean, among this sea of Republicans?
There were some. Most of the Democrats were either State Department diplomats or career military officers who by law could not be queried about their political affiliation before they were sent to Baghdad. And a handful of them actually formed their own little support group that they called Donkeys in the Desert. And they would meet once a week to sort of talk about democratic issues. They put some posters up initially to advertise their meetings. And just like you might expect in a high school, a lot of them were defaced. They were yanked from the walls or they were scribbled with graffiti. But this group did persist in meeting. They at one point screened Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. But unless they were among their own, they never really openly advertised their political affiliation. One of the donkeys compared being a Democrat in the Green Zone to being gay in small town America. And he said, you know, if you know what's good for you, you just stay in the closet.
You know, you describe this world in which there are all of these civilian employees, many of them young, who have this sort of recreated American suburban world where there's familiar food and familiar vehicles and restaurants and bars. And outside, you have this country that's sort of unraveling. What do you think the effect of that isolation was on those who had to figure out how this country was going to rebuild itself?
Well, they had no sense of what reality was like on the ground, what Iraqis needed, what they wanted, what was practical, what was doable. And so you'd have groups of very well-meaning, very earnest young Americans who would sit around in conference rooms in the palace and diagram using dry erase boards and notepads what the country needed. They'd work up on their PowerPoint presentations. Well, Iraqi schools need this or Iraqi hospitals need that. And it was well-intentioned, but it bore no resemblance to what was really happening. And it wound up being a process that really didn't involve lots of Iraqis. And the Iraqis that it did involve were Iraqis who were sort of self-selected. There were Iraqis who felt comfortable enough with the Americans that they would want to get jobs working with them or would want to come into the Green Zone. And Iraqis who also were slightly opportunistic, who knew that eventually the Americans would cede power back to them, and that if they were sort of telling the Americans what they wanted to hear, they might be best positioned to get that power and to get lucrative reconstruction contracts. So these people inside the Green Zone wound up essentially operating in an echo chamber.
Can you think of an example something that you observed which illustrates that lack of connection, someone devising plans which had really no connection to what was needed, what was happening?
Yeah, let me tell you about a day in early 2004. Suicide bombers detonated their explosive-laden belts outside a very large Shiite shrine in Baghdad, killing dozens upon dozens of people. And I spent the morning out there walking through the carnage, seeing corpses, seeing piles of shoes of the dead, experiencing Iraq at its very worst, at its most bloody. And that evening, I went into the Green Zone to meet somebody for dinner, and I sat in the palace dining hall. And this, mind you, was such a catastrophic attack that Iraqi political leaders essentially declared 3 days of mourning. It was all anybody outside could talk about, and it had really racked the country. And I went inside the Green Zone for a dinner and sat in a table with people and started talking to them. And I asked one of the people at my table what he thought of what had happened earlier today. And his response was so blasé. It was, oh, yeah, I think I saw something about that on my office television, but I didn't really watch it because I was too busy working on my democracy project. And I was just blown away. You know, what good is a democracy project if outside these walls, innocent people get blown up while going to the mosque? And there just seemed to be this huge disconnect between the security situation on the outside, between what really mattered to Iraqis and what mattered to the Americans inside the Emerald City.
You write quite a bit about efforts to recast the Iraqi economy by some conservative Americans who really saw it a chance to kind of bring unleash the benefits of free enterprise in this struggling country. You write that Tom Foley, who was an investment banker, a Republican donor, and actually a classmate of the president when he was at the Harvard Business School, headed the Office of Private Sector Development, who thought his mission was to privatize all of Iraq's state-owned industries within 30 days. How well did this work?
It was an utter disaster. Foley and the others who showed up there viewed Iraq as their quiescent terrarium to implement neoconservative economic ideas that they have never been able to implement in this country. I mean, they showed up in a country where unemployment was at best 40%, perhaps as bad as 50 or 60%, with an ossified socialist structure. And what did they think needed to be done? You know, not a sort of a New Deal jobs program. Hey, what Iraq needs, they said, is a flat tax. And they implemented this 15% flat tax. They engaged in tariff reduction. They implemented a whole host of legal changes that were designed for Iraq's ascension to the World Trade Organization. Before Ambassador Bremer left the country, he rewrote Iraq's laws governing microchip design, genetically modified seed varietals, intellectual property protections, all sorts of things that in the eyes of many people who look at Iraq were sort of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. This was a country that needed some basic economic stimulus. It needed money pumped in, perhaps to sort of low-wage, low-skill jobs, but getting people back to work.
Iraq was a country that under Saddam Hussein had a number of state-owned enterprises, which the Americans thought would be best put in private hands. Give us an example of how well that worked or didn't.
Well, what the Americans thought should be done was this sort of big bang privatization effort. Bring in a bunch of foreign investors, sell off all of these companies, and hey, we're off to the races. Well, the reality was far, far more complicated than that, because you had more than 150 government-run factories. Most of these things had been looted. There was no electricity service. Many of the employees had gone home, not knowing when they needed to report back. And so there was this large effort that needed to be implemented to actually just get these things working again. And once you get them working, then maybe you can sell them off. But the U.S. government never devoted enough people to this effort. At best, there were two or three people assigned to the task of trying to get these 150 factories that employed a collective 100,000 people back to work. And a few months into it, they brought over some Germans to advise them because of their experience in privatizing government factories in the former East Germany. And the team of Germans sat there and with the three Americans on the other side of the table and said, "So tell us about your efforts here. Tell us, how many people do you have working on this?" And one of the three Americans said, "Well, you're looking at them." And the German said, "Well, no. Not the people in charge. How many people overall do you have?" "We had like 8,000 people in our country working on this effort." And the Americans say, "No, it's just three." And the German said, "Don't even bother trying." But we tried. We thought that, you know, it wasn't important to really get these things back up and running, that foreign investors would flock to Iraq and would buy up these things. Well, we all know now that that never happened. Nobody really wanted to come into a war-ravaged country where you couldn't even fly in commercially into the airport, that the road from the airport into the city was incredibly dangerous and was infiltrated by insurgents, that any private company would be willing to come in and invest in Iraq.
Rajiv Chandrasekharan's new book is Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Puccini's Ghost, a novel of psychological suspense by Morag Yass, author of Half-Broken Things. From TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Music from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Coming up, we'll talk with Ed Harris about his starring role as Beethoven in the new film Copying Beethoven. Also, we continue our conversation with Rajiv Chandrasekharan about the U.S. occupation of Iraq. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Rajiv Chandrasekharan's new book about the occupation in Iraq is called Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. He writes about the protected enclave for Westerners in Baghdad and the efforts of coalition administrators to transform the Iraqi economy and government. I asked him about the American who was supposed to rebuild the country's public health system.
Jim Haviman was the former director of community health care in Michigan. He essentially ran the Medicare and Medicaid system in the state of Michigan. He didn't have much international experience. He had done some work for an evangelical Christian organization promoting development of the third world. Prior to that, he had run a large adoption agency that had encouraged women not to have abortions. And Haverman got his job because the Republican governor of Michigan, John Engler, recommended him to Paul Wolfowitz. And Haverman, you know, eventually was put on a plane out to Baghdad. Haverman replaced a man who has been described by people at USAID as the single most talented healthcare professional who deals with post-conflict environments. A guy who has a medical degree, which Jim Haverman didn't, a guy who has four postgraduate degrees, two Bronze Stars, who's a senior person at USAID, who had worked in northern Iraq after the 91 Gulf War, who had been in Kosovo and Somalia. But a few weeks after the liberation of Baghdad, this guy, his name is Skip Burkle, he got an email from a senior official back in Washington saying that the White House, quote unquote, wanted a loyalist in the job. And so Haverman comes out there, and you know, Iraq's hospitals were decrepit. They didn't have basic things like CAT scans and ample anesthesia and antibiotics and all the things that we take for granted here in this country. And meanwhile, people getting attacked by insurgents were the sort of single largest healthcare challenge in the country. And Haverman decides, well, you know, I'm really not going to put lots of money to fixing Iraqi hospitals just yet. I think we need to sort of approach this in a different mindset. We need to encourage Iraqis not to come to hospitals when they have basic ailments. So he wanted to set up a system of little primary care clinics. And then, perhaps, you know, most crazily, he tried to do something that he had done in Michigan that had saved some money. He had forced Medicare providers in Michigan to buy drugs off of a list called a formulary. And he looked at Iraq's healthcare system and saw that in Iraq, the government actually imports lots of medicines for hospitals because healthcare is free. Incidentally, Haverman didn't like the idea that healthcare was free and wanted to start charging people kind of co-payments to come in to see doctors. But so Haverman sees this formula that Iraq has and says, we need to rewrite this, and brings over a team of experts from this country to rewrite this list of drugs that they import. But it was this classic example of focusing in on one little part of the problem and neglecting the much broader issue. It wasn't that Iraq had sort of an old-fashioned list of drugs it was importing. It was that the entire system of drug procurement and distribution was broken to the core. And Haverman really didn't focus on fixing that. His idea was, oh, we'll just privatize that. We'll sell it off to somebody. That'll work. And when it became clear that nobody really wanted to buy this big dysfunctional mess and assume the responsibility of distributing drugs. And by the way, Iraqi leaders didn't want some private company doing this. They felt this was important for the government to do. There was no real plan in place to fix it. So by the time Haverman left, by the time the United States handed over sovereignty back to the Iraqis, a huge percentage of drugs that were deemed essential by the health ministry were just unavailable in the country. And the Iraqi interim government had to go to the United Nations for help, had to beseech its neighbors for assistance, because the Americans in the months they were there had failed to just accomplish the basic task of ordering and distributing the most essential drugs that Iraqi hospitals needed.
You know, you paint a picture of a number of these efforts to sort of transplant American free enterprise to Iraq, which came to nothing. And of course, as when the Coalition Provisional Authority closed, a lot of these folks left and came back to the United States. I'm wondering if once they were back in the States, and as you began doing follow-up research from the book, did you contact them and did they have a different perspective on their experience in Iraq?
It's a really good question. And the answer is, for many of them, yes. People who were true believers back in their days in Iraq, as when they returned home, they re-entered their normal lives, they started to see Iraq from afar and started to see the consequences of what they did. And they started to come to understand that Iraq was not going to turn into a secular, stable democracy anytime soon. A number of them started to become disillusioned. And a number of those people actually were very helpful to me as I worked on my book. People who I talked to only very briefly while I was out in Baghdad, upon their return, became so frustrated that they were willing to share with me documents and emails and explain to me what really happened in there, that the facade of loyalty that the administration had sought to show and create in Iraq started to break down, sort of as everything else in that country began to break down.
Do you have a sense of how the green zone might be different today? I mean, do we have as many Republican and conservative loyalists running thing, and does the place feel different?
Fortunately, there aren't as many, and that's because the State Department is in charge. It's no longer a special Pentagon operation, and the State Department has brought out a lot of very talented diplomats, many people who speak Arabic, who have experience working in other countries, in other post-conflict zones. And so there's been a real professionalization. And that started to happen as early as mid-2004, as soon as Ambassador Bremer left and the Coalition Provisional Authority was dissolved. And so that's been a positive sign. The green zone, if anything, is even more fortified. There are more checkpoints. There are more little blast walls. The days of Americans being able to walk even into the parking lot of the palace to go to the PX, the store there, to go to the Chinese restaurants. That's all over with. You can't do that anymore. The Green Zone Cafe that I mentioned in the book, well, that was hit by a suicide bomber in late 2004. So if anything, it's a enclave that feels even more like it's under siege than it did back then.
Well, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran's new book is Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. Coming up, actor Ed Harris. This is Fresh Air. Ed Harris has been acting in films, television, and on stage for 30 years, earning a reputation for thorough preparation and intense performances. He earned Oscar nominations for his roles in Apollo 13, The Truman Show, The Hours, and Pollock, which he also directed. His other films include A Beautiful Mind, The Right Stuff, and HBO's Empire Falls. Next month, Harris stars at New York's Public Theater in Rex, a play written and directed by Neil LaBute. Harris has played a number of real historical figures, astronaut John Glenn, artist Jackson Pollock, and Watergate figure Howard Hunt. Now in his new film, Harris plays the composer Ludwig von Beethoven in a film directed by Agnieszka Holland called Copying Beethoven. It's the fictional story of a young woman who lands a job copying musical scores for Beethoven near the end of his life. Beethoven is at first reluctant to have the help of a young woman, especially as he prepares his Ninth Symphony. In this scene, Harris, as Beethoven, is in a tavern talking with his friend, the tavern owner. He's wondering if he should send the woman away or see her as a sign from God.
This new symphony, it's my farewell.
You're not that sick.
No. My farewell to music, as I've always known it, as I've always written it.
You've been talking about that for years, Louis.
I'm starting a new chapter in my life. New forms, a new language. And now this woman is sent to me at this very moment. What if she was sent by him?
Women are usually sent by the other one.
No, suppose it's a sign.
A sign for what, Louis?
That it's time.
A time for what?
A time for me to join with him.
Well, if it's true, and she was sent by him, and she's waiting in your apartment, you shouldn't be sitting here drinking, should you?
To prepare for the role, Harris spent months taking piano and violin lessons. I asked him if the lessons were for the moments when he plays those instruments on screen or to inform his performance in some other way.
Well, kind of both. I mean, I knew I would have to play a little bit on screen, but also just, I mean, I grew up, I played, piano 2 years in second and third grade or something, and then I played the baritone horn, which is kind of a cross between a tuba and a French horn, through high school. So, I mean, I knew music, could read music, but my life is not really centered around music. And so it was to play the piano, but it was also to just infuse my life with music and to be thinking about it all the time and to practice every day and to know that this was where this man lived. You know, he was constantly with music, constantly in his head, constantly composing. And, you know, so it just helped kind of fill me up.
And what about his personality, his physical mannerisms? I mean, how did you get to that? Was that based on contemporary descriptions or biographies?
Well, the film really covers the last couple of years of his life, kind of condenses. Mm-hmm. It begins when he's in the middle of finishing the Ninth Symphony, and goes to his death. And, you know, there's some wonderful drawings of him on the street, friends that, you know, drew pictures of him at the time. And he was quite an eccentric guy, particularly at this time in his life. And there's descriptions of him walking through the street and people kind of, you know, getting out of his way and dogs barking at him, because he was a bit of an odd fellow. And he would walk slightly bent forward with his hands clasped behind his back and kind of always be hearing something in his head, always hearing some music in his head. So that kind of posture helped a little bit.
One of the most memorable scenes in this film is the one where you, as Beethoven, are conducting an orchestra, debuting the Ninth Symphony. And, of course, this is not one that we can really give the audience your performance on radio, because you have no lines. It's all visual. But let's just give the audience just a sense of the power of some of this music. This is a magnificent scene in which you're debuting the Ninth Symphony as Beethoven. Talk a little bit about the challenge of recording this. You've got a full orchestra, a full chorus.
We had a full orchestra. We were working down in a little town called Kecskemét, which is south of Budapest, and we shot this in Hungary. And it was a local orchestra and choir. They had to bring in some outside musicians to fill in the orchestra, because there were no women in the orchestras at that time. And we shot it in maybe 3.5 days. We used a recording, a Hi-Tink recording, from the Decca record collection that we had access to. It was the best recording in Jeskefelt that represented this piece of music. So that music would always be piped in very loud, you know, loudly enough so that the orchestra that was actually playing could hear it and play along with it. Because otherwise it would have been hell to mix if we were recording live with the orchestra. So I'm conducting them, and they are playing live. And we just, we worked our butts off for, you know, long 3 days. It's about a 12-minute segment. It has some pieces from the first, second, and fourth movement of the Ninth Symphony. And, boy, I tell you, it was thrilling. I mean, especially when they would cut the actual recording and I would keep conducting the orchestra, and then the choir would come in and we'd finish up the final movement, and then everybody would just go, yeah, you know. It was really just thrilling. I'd worked really hard on it. It's a difficult piece of music. I mean, there are some portions of the symphony where it's a thing that conductors study for years, you know.
You know, this film calls to mind Pollock, at which you directed and co-produced. About the famous painter Jackson Pollock. What so fascinated you about Pollock?
I think initially it was the obstacles, the personal obstacles that he had to overcome to achieve what he did, his kind of demons, the tormented kind of life that he had, his problems with alcohol, his kind of antisocial behavior. I mean, there was parts of that that I identified with, not so much in my in the present day, but I recall when I first began acting, it was such a private thing for me. I felt very uncomfortable in the presence of other people, and I was not much of a social animal. And I just really had a lot of empathy for this guy as a man, you know. And then when I began to look at his art and try to appreciate what he'd done, the more time I spent with it, deeper and deeper I got involved, and I became obsessed with the guy. You know, I had to do this.
Well, and as you mentioned, you began painting, and I think the scenes in the film Pollock, at which you are Pollock painting, are pretty compelling. And I was wondering there, when you're doing those scenes, are you thinking about the work of art you're creating, or are you thinking of,
No, I was really just trying to paint something that had merit. You know, unfortunately, you know, I would actually be creating something that I felt was working when the camera was on the canvas, you know, most of the time. A couple things in there that I thought were trash, but when the camera was, but then the camera would turn around on me, and to save canvas, to save time, etc., I would keep working on the same piece. And so I would kind of like screw them up, you know, a bit. So I didn't really accomplish anything that I was too proud of. But there were moments along the way where I felt really good about what I was doing. But yeah, it was always just focusing on the work. It was, I had really studied the way he painted, you know, with the Namath film and all that. Had built a little studio for myself so I could work on the floor in a larger space. And so in the film, really the filming those painting scenes were probably the easiest part of the movie for me because it was the most freeing, you know.
Well, you know, the other thing about this film, of course, is that you didn't just act in it. You were its director, which is, of course, a whole nother workload when you're making a film. There is a story, and sometimes these get exaggerated in the telling, but I read that there was one moment where I think to get your co-star Marcia Gay Harden's attention, you threw a chair. Did this really happen? Do you recall this episode?
I probably did. It's that scene where she comes out of the bath and talk about having children, and I just knew that there was a deeper place that she could get with it, and I just tried to shake her up a little bit, you know, which she didn't mind.
Yeah, well, she said that you really helped her get to a place she would never have otherwise gotten.
Yeah. I mean, working with Marcia Gay was great, and it's kind of the way Agnieszka works with me. I mean, you can pretty much say anything, do anything with someone that you're that feels that comfortable with you and vice versa. You know, they know you're not trying to manipulate them. They know that you're just trying to get them to deal with something that maybe they're not getting down to, you know.
Well, I think we ought to listen to that clip then. This is from the film Pollock. My guest Ed Harris and his co-star Marcia Gay Harden.
Let's make a baby.
No.
No. Am I missing something here? Are you missing something?
We can't.
We can't?
My life is full enough with you, Jackson.
Wait a minute, where are you going? Don't walk away from me. We're husband and wife. I want to have a baby, our baby. That's what the progression of things is about. That's what the union is about.
That's not what the union is about.
Well, what else is there?
That's not what it's about, Jackson.
For me?
The vows don't stipulate baby. I am not going to bring another life into that.
And that was my guest Ed Harris and his co-star Marcia Gay Harden in the film Pollock. We're speaking with Ed Harris. His new film is copying Beethoven. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Ed Harris. He's debuting in New York, a new play by Neil LaBute called Rex. He's also appearing in the new film, Copying Beethoven. You have another memorable role in A History of Violence, and I thought we would listen to a piece of you speaking with Maria Bello. This is the scene where you're playing Carl Fogarty, who is a Philadelphia thug who has come into town seeking revenge on a gangster who had disappeared and who it now turns out appears to be working in this town. And Maria Bello is his wife and doesn't believe her husband has anything to do with you and your fellow gangsters. In this scene, she has lost track of her daughter shopping for shoes in a mall, and she discovers that the daughter is near you as Carl Fogarty. Let's listen.
Nothing to worry about, Mrs. Stahl. I've been watching over her.
You stay the away from my family, you son of a.
There's no need for that kind of language, Mrs. Stahl.
Listen to me. I don't know what you want, and I don't really care.
You should care about what I want, Mrs. Stahl, because I want something from your husband that might affect you, might change your life.
My husband does not know you. He wouldn't know you, somebody like you.
Oh, he knows Carl Fogarty, all right. He knows me intimately. See? This isn't a completely dead eye. It still works a bit. Problem is, the only thing I can see with it is Joey Cusack. And it can see right through him. Right through your husband, Edie. See what's inside him, what makes him tick. He's still the same guy. He's still crazy Joey. And you know it, don't you?
I know that my husband is Tom Stahl. That's what I know.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, why don't you ask Tom about his older brother, Richie?
He does.
Ask Tom about how he tried to rip my eye out with barbed wire. And ask him, Edie, how come he's so good at killing people?
That's my guest, Ed Harris, from the film A History of Violence. Boy, you're a scary guy there, you know? You know, one of the things about the character there, I mean, your character, Carl Fogarty, is disfigured. He has an eye damage from a previous encounter with this guy he has been stalking. In the Beethoven film, you're wearing all this period stuff that really transforms you physically. And I'm wondering, do those physical trappings help you kind of internalize the character in any way? I mean, because you don't have them when you're rehearsing, when you're thinking about the part.
Right. No, very much so, particularly in the Beethoven thing. I mean, you know, I don't have much hair at all, so to have a big full head of hair, and we did some little bit of alteration facially, and it helped a great deal because, and in the period costumes, I mean, it gives you a certain, much different feeling on your body. I'd also put on some weight for this role because Beethoven was a rather stocky fellow, and so all of that helps not just visibly when you check yourself out in the mirror, but it also definitely helps internalize and feel comfortable in your skin and know that you are, you know, give you the freedom to feel and imagine yourself as this other person.
When you're getting a role together, when you're before you're shooting and you're imagining how you're going to animate this character, do you ever put on stuff or trying to do things to sort of put yourself in the period?
Well, you know, there's a lot of little things you do in the privacy of your own home or studio, wherever you happen to be, that are probably different for every actor, and they kind of going to remain private. You know, it's a lot easier to do that sometimes on your own than it is in a rehearsal with even other actors, you know. I mean, it's different in theater because you know, you're rehearsing a play and you have weeks to work physically, internally, with the script, with the beats of the drama or whatever it might be, with the fellow actors, and find out where you're going to go. And if you work on something physically, privately, you bring it in, you're working on it in rehearsal. But on film, you really don't have that much rehearsal time. You show up, the cameras are rolling, you got to be ready to go, man. So, you know, there's a lot, it's a little bit of a different kind of work that way. Filmically.
Do you prefer one or the other? I mean, I know you're doing a play now.
No, I enjoy both. I mean, I hadn't done a play in 10 years prior to doing this Neil LaBute play in Ireland last fall, and Well, it was, I just had a great time, and I'm really looking forward to doing it at the Public here pretty soon, so.
Right, that's debuting in New York in October, right?
Yeah.
Maybe you should just say a little bit about that. You did it in Europe at Cork, Ireland. This is a play at which you're sort of narrating a kind of a mourning process, is that right, for someone who's died?
Well, no, it's really kind of a love story. I mean, it's a one-character play about a man whose wife has passed, she happens to be on the stage in the casket. I mean, the casket's closed. And he kind of removes himself from the wake, the group of people that are here to say goodbye to her, and he really addresses the audience and talks to them about their relationship. And it's some of it's pretty funny, some of it's hopefully kind of moving, and has a few labutisms in there, and it's a pretty entertaining evening.
Well, Ed Harris, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave. It's been great to be on the show. Appreciate it.
Actor Ed Harris. He stars in the new film Copying Beethoven, and next month he'll be at New York's Public Theater starring in Rex, the play written and directed by Neil LaBute. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, working to make cancer a national priority at Celebration on the Hill. Details at acscan.org. And from Hollywood Records, presenting Indigo Girls' new album, Despite Our Differences, available in stores September 19th. More information at indigogirls.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the greatest story ever sold, the decline and fall of truth from 9/11 to Katrina. We talk with New York Times columnist Frank Rich about the theater of politics. Join us for the next Fresh Air.